Center for the Study of Violence, co-founded Yale's Violence and Health Study Group, and leads an academic collaborators group for the World Health Organization. She is the lead organizer of the Duty to Warn conference at Yale University, out of which emerged the best-selling book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 37 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President, and joins us to discuss her new book, just out, Profile of a Nation, Trump's Mind, America's Soul. And joining us now is Sarah Lee Whitson, who's Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, DAWN, an organization founded by Jamal Khashoggi. And Michael Eisner is the General Counsel and Chief Operating Officer for Democracy for the Arab World, and he's a former attorney advisor to the United States Department of State. So let me begin with you, Sarah. Obviously, there's going to be a battle over the arms sale to the UAE, the $23 billion in military sales. At this point, how do you see it playing out? Will we reach a point of where the Senate won't be able to override the president's veto? Is that kind of the way it's going to shape up? Or is there a possibility to stop this arms sales?
I don't think that this is going to be something that will have enough votes to override a Trump veto. Unfortunately, I think this is now playing out to become more of a partisan issue of Republicans versus Democrats, which is what I'm predicting we'll see in the Senate vote that's slated for later today. More importantly, more significantly, is what President-elect Biden will do in January once he's inaugurated, and whether he will use a strong message from Congress that is sent today and has been sent already repeatedly, that they oppose, that the American public opposes these arms sales for very serious reasons. Most significantly, that they will harm America's interests and harm the interests of the people in the region who've been terrorized by the UAE and its oversized military grandiose ambitions for the past several years.
And you're talking about the people in Yemen, largely?
Well, sadly, not just Yemen. We have seen the UAE intervene militarily in Libya in total violation of the UN Security Council arms embargo, despite the stern consternation of the U.S. and the UN Security Council. It's carrying out airstrikes there, operates a military base there, and is wreaking havoc. We have seen the UAE threaten to invade Qatar, a neighboring country. We know that the UAE has been involved in Somalia, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria. So it's extraterritorial or engagement, involvement, and expansionism is quite broad.
And Michael Eisner, I understand that Jared Kushner has been working the phones on Senate Republicans. I don't know what credibility he has with them at this point, although they're obviously being intimidated by President Trump, since only, I think, about 26 or 27 Republican lawmakers have actually had the courage to admit the obvious, which is that Joe Biden won the election. But how much does the fact that Prime Minister Netanyahu is pushing this or giving this arms deal a blessing, because previous efforts to block arms sales to both Saudi Arabia and the UAE, the fact that they may take away Israel's advantage has always been the factor that has scuttled the deals. That clearly is not happening now, right?
Yeah, I think it's a key factor. Really, what's the key factor is the lack of Israeli opposition. Reports indicate that the arms deal was part of the normalization agreement that culminated in the Abraham Accords and normalized relations between Israel and the UAE and Bahrain. And subsequent to that, there was this arms deal in which the United States, the largest arms deal of the Trump administration, a $23 billion arms deal, including these 50 F-35s fighter jets that we're talking about. And Israel has essentially stood down, including AIPAC. Netanyahu, AIPAC, Israel's defenders have not opposed the arms deal. If they had, I think the arms deal would be in trouble, great trouble. But the fact really that they have essentially not called in their chits here, makes it extremely unlikely that that Trump's veto can be overridden.
And again, I'm speaking with Sarah Lee Whitson and Michael Eisner. Sarah Lee Whitson is Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World, DAWN, an organization founded by Jamal Khashoggi. And Michael Eisner is General Counsel and Chief Operating Officer of Democracy for the Arab World, DAWN. And he's a former attorney advisor at the United States Department of State. So, Sarah, could you describe the Abraham Accords, the so-called peace deal between Israel and UAE and Saudi Arabia, as really an arms deal? That's pretty much the way it really looks. And that is this, in a broader sense, an effort to change the subject away from the Arab-Israeli conflict to the Arab-Iranian conflict?
I think that's a very accurate description. This deal is not about peace, and frankly, it's got nothing to do with the Palestinians. This Abraham Accord was a very clear quid pro quo, a brilliant strategic move by Israel, for which it basically offered the UAE protection, lobbying, bringing it within the orbit of Israeli protection in the U.S. politics in exchange for normalization and in exchange, of course, for its support for this UAE arms deal, which, by the way, is one that includes a bonus to Israel, because when the arms deal goes through, the Israelis will be rewarded with additional free gifts from the United States taxpayers to make up for this expanded Emirati military arsenal so that they can maintain their so-called qualitative military edge. The absurdity of that requirement, that we need to protect Israel from another country in the region becoming military powerful, is really evidenced in this deal, when in fact Israel is championing this arms deal to the UAE. It has been widely reported that AIPAC and other Israel lobbyists and pro-Israel think tanks are lobbying for the deal, in addition to Jim Mattis lobbying for the deal. And even some preliminary reports that General Petraeus is lobbying for the deal. So now, by virtue of these Abraham Accords, you have not only the military-industrial complex and its agents, like Jim Mattis, lobbying for this massive arms deal, but you have Israel and Israel's lobbyists lobbying for this massive arms deal to the UAE. And that's what makes this joining this Abraham Accord so tempting for Saudi Arabia, because they know they're in the doghouse when the Biden administration starts. And the best protection they can buy is Israel's protection and Israeli lobby protection vis-a-vis U.S. politicians.
Well, let me ask you, Michael Eisner, about what happened there in that secret meeting that took place with Secretary of State Pompeo, Mohammed bin Salman, and MBZ, the head of the UAE, and Netanyahu. They all secretly arrived there. My understanding is that perhaps the strike on the killing of the Iranian nuclear scientist was a kind of consolation prize, because MBS did not want to really go toe-to-toe with the Iranians, because they last time they sent a pretty powerful signal blowing up Abqaiq, and next time around they could really hurt the oil infrastructure in Saudi Arabia, and he wasn't really ready for a full-on recognition of Israel. My understanding is one of the problems with this deal that Netanyahu and Kushner have cooked up is that it involves throwing Egypt under the bus, because it's a lot to do with the idea of making Israel the gateway for the export into the Mediterranean, into Europe, for Gulf oil and gas, which would basically make the Suez Canal irrelevant. Is that something that's going on here on a broader strategic level?
Well, the meeting itself was for Secretary Pompeo a last push for a huge, a big success, a Abraham Accords, essentially, for the Saudi Arabians who were not, and MBS was just not ready to get on board with the agreement. With he has his own domestic constituents that he has to factor in, and it's just a question of time when he will essentially enter, normalize with Israel and enter into an agreement. He wasn't ready to do that. Netanyahu and Pompeo pushed him But he, perhaps wisely, held out because he needs something in which to bargain with the Biden administration. And he has a big chit, and that chit is relations normalization with Israel. So that was a disappointment for the Trump administration. Sarah Lee, do you...
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I can't comment on the extent to which Egypt is being thrown under the bus with plans to divert imports and exports and for the Suez no longer to be the gatekeeper. Certainly that would be a blow to Egypt, but it's already the very junior partner in this relationship. It's the poor pauper that depends on handouts from the U.S., from the UAE, from Saudi Arabia, and serves very little strategic purpose in the broader coalition of Israel, UAE, and Saudi Arabia. And it has been a fact that the Egyptian elites have just found so distasteful and unwilling to grapple with. More significantly, as I think Mike was saying, is that the Saudis understand now what this is all about, and they are very pissed off that the Israelis leaked the fact of the meeting, of Bibi's meeting with MBS, because that is very politically damaging to MBS inside the country. The assassination of the nuclear scientist does not make Saudis safer, certainly doesn't make Emiratis safer, if they would think about it. And they realize that they are now in a position to extract concessions of their own from Israel, which I assure you is not going to have anything to do with the Palestinian people, is going to have everything to do with protecting and immunizing MBS. And that includes not only more arms sales to Saudi Arabia, no suspension of arms sales to Saudi Arabia, but also, for example, granting MBS immunity from prosecution, because he faces a slew of lawsuits in the United States. And that's why he hasn't dared set foot in Washington since he killed Jamal Khashoggi.
So, Michael Eisner, my understanding is, Michael Eisner, is that MBS really has no time for the Palestinians. He almost has contempt for them. But I guess he's not in a position to display that publicly. But in terms of being bogged down in Yemen, and I thought that actually the Emiratis were trying to back out of it to some extent, but they never consulted the Egyptians, right? The Egyptians have some pretty bad historical memories of getting bogged down in Yemen. Is there an end game there? Does MBS have a way to get out of this, or is he, because he's obviously impetuous and feels completely entitled, and the fact that he killed Khashoggi in such a way indicates this extraordinary arrogance of this sort of boy king punk.
Yeah, MBS and the UAE went to war now 5 years ago in 2015, thinking that it would be an easy cakewalk of a couple months to conquer Yemen. And that has lasted 5 years with extraordinary, the largest humanitarian catastrophe in the world. Right now, there is no end game. The Saudis and, as you said, the UAE has pulled back a little, but they're still very much involved. They might not be on the ground as much, although they do have soldiers there, but they're funding military contractors, Russians, Americans, who are doing the dirty work. And they are running a prison in which torture is taking place. Right now, though, neither country has such an interest in bringing about an end. But a multilateral effort, you can expect the Biden administration to come in with a multilateral effort to ease tensions and create some accord amongst the parties. Now, it's just a stalemate.
And Sarah, Michael mentioned that MBS is holding back on a deal with Israel as a chip in his bargaining with Biden. Biden has made it pretty clear he's pretty disgusted with MBS. Is there any chance all the royals that have been ripped off and beaten and tortured, they all hate this upstart? Is there any chance, because he's obviously, at the moment, he's actually hiding behind his father, even though he wants to replace his father, who apparently has dementia. Is there any chance that he won't become king?
I mean, it's certainly there's a chance. And the reason there's a chance is just because of the inherent instability of a system like Saudi Arabia's, which happens in cloaks and daggers behind the scenes. He won't be the first Saudi king or king-elect to be murdered or kidnapped. And we all watch with bated breath to not know what's happening behind the curtain. And the reason why MBS has locked up so many royals, the reason why he's travel banned thousands of royal family members, you know, brothers, sisters, children, the reason why he's taken children of former government officials hostage is because he sees a coup plot in every corner, in every house, in every town, because he knows he has no legitimacy and no stability, and he knows that he's also hated by many, many people. So certainly there's a possibility, but at the same time, I would hate to encourage his paranoid delusions, which is exactly what's led him to travel ban the royal elites of the country.
There is opposition, but we'll see if it can coalesce around real action. There's no rule of law. Ultimately, there has to be some kind of institutions and rule of law to protect all the royals and others in the country against the wrath of this unpredictable ruler and autocratic ruler.
But what can Biden do, just in the last minute or so here, Michael Eisner, what can Biden do? Because I understand the diplomatic and intelligence establishment in Washington don't like MBS, and they were counting on Nayef, who has been held in house arrest and has been shaken down by MBS. Is there any chance that Biden could put pressure on them somehow or other to prevent MBS from becoming king?
Well, one of the questions, Ian, is what is our role? Is our role to promote democracies in the Middle East? We haven't done that so well. See Iraq. But one thing we can do is do no harm. And that's a principle, and the Hippocratic principle in medicine. But it's been applied lately by a lot of conservative and liberal foreign policymakers. And doing no harm would involve what we're doing now, which is empowering MBS, providing cover for MBS, supplying weapons for his arsenal. So whereas it's not U.S. responsibility to go in there and remake Saudi Arabia in the form of a democracy, what we can do is stop empowering MBS. And Biden should do that immediately. Unfortunately, there has been a history amongst both the Democrat and Republican Party of doing harm, of supplying weapons, of providing cover for human rights violations. We're hoping to see a change in the new administration.
And Sarah, a quick last word from you.
I mean, really, all eyes are on the Biden administration now. He made some very serious commitments about ending America's role in the war in Yemen, about ending arms sales to Saudi Arabia, about changing our relationship with the dictators of this region. And in January, we'll know how serious he is, and we'll know how far he's willing to take on the Israel lobby, the defense industry lobby, the Saudi lobby, the Emirati lobby, who are spending a huge amount of money to make sure that doesn't happen. I'll just say that we're going to be watching closely and pushing very hard.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today, Sarah Lee Whitson and Michael Eisner. Sarah Lee Whitson, of course, is Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World, DAWN, an organization founded by Jamal Khashoggi. And Michael Eisner is General Counsel and Chief Operating Officer of Democracy for the Arab World, DAWN, and he's a former Attorney Advisor to the United States Department of State. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with a forensic psychiatrist, author of the new book, Profile of a Nation, Trump's Mind, America's Soul. And we'll be looking into how America can heal itself from having an abuser as head of the country who has made the American public his victims.
He fastened all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now, Dr. Bandy Lee, a forensic psychiatrist on the faculty of Yale School of Medicine, who served as director of research for the Center for the Study of Violence, co-founded Yale's Violence and Health Study Group. She is the lead organizer of the Duty to Warn conference at Yale University, out of which came the best-selling book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 37 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President. And her latest book just out is Profile of a Nation, Trump's Mind, America's Soul. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Bandy Lee.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Well, thanks for joining us. And of course, President Trump got 73 million votes, and about 70% of those that voted for him believe he won the elections and that the Democrats stole it. And that could be a powerful block in this country that would continually frustrate the incoming President Biden's ability to govern. So
that's right.
Trump may be on the way out, but his influence is not going to go away, and his influence will be incredibly destructive. And that is, unfortunately, the situation we're in now.
Yes.
But given that your book asks a lot of important questions, such as, and answers them, I think, more to the point, why does Donald Trump speak and act as he does? Why does he need to deny the obvious seriousness of the pandemic? Why must he provoke violence? Why do many in the country still support and follow him? What caused his ascendancy in the first place? Those, of course, are questions that have haunted me, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners. But the good news is that your book answers those questions, right?
Yes, it's tempting to provide a comprehensive profile of Donald Trump in the context of his followers and the nation as a whole from a psychological perspective, which has not been provided to the public in a way that I believe it should have been.
And how does it meld CIA profiling techniques into what you've done?
So whereas the American Psychiatric Association has prohibited mental health professionals from making assessments from a distance, even though there are plenty of things we could speak about and educate the public on, they have been practicing at a distance evaluations, even diagnosis of foreign leaders for over 70 years. And I have been close friends with renowned CIA profiler, Dr. Gerald Post, who recently passed, but he established the Center for the Study of Personality Profiles in Politics for the CIA. And so after having had a very close friendship with him for a couple years at least, especially with respect to the troubling profile of Donald Trump, I've picked up a lot in terms of the methods he uses to profile and the importance he places on leader-follower relationships, and also bringing my public health background to the situation. I felt that I could provide a rigorous, comprehensive profile of the nation for the public so that the public can protect itself the way that we have protected ourselves against foreign leaders through psychological profiling.
And in terms of your practice, as a forensic psychiatrist, you deal with violent offenders, do you not, in prison? And
That's right.
So just describe in a broader sense what you learn from trying to understand the violent impulses of these people and how they relate to Donald Trump.
Yes. So as a forensic psychiatrist works at the interface of psychiatry and the law. And so so I do a lot of testimonies for courts, evaluate violent offenders, and I treat violent offenders in prisons and jails. And so and specialize in treating them. That's why when Donald Trump was elected to the presidency, I felt the need to separate from my usual clinical and academic practice to speak up about what I saw, because I've seen at least 1,000 individuals with his exact psychological structure. And that's why I focused the first book, which I edited and collected essays on, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. As you would note, the focus is on dangerousness, not on mental illness, not on other factors, although all those things can play into the dangerousness. The dangerousness is what is important. And mental health professionals actually assess dangerousness far more often than they diagnose and treat mental illnesses. And this is something that the public may not be aware of.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Bandy Lee, a forensic psychiatrist on the faculty of Yale School of Medicine, who served as director of research for the Center for the Study of Violence, co-founded Yale's Violence and Health Study Group, and leads an academic collaborators group for the World Health Organization. She's a lead organizer of the Duty to Warn conference at Yale University, out of which came the best-selling book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 37 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President. And her latest book just out is Profile of a Nation, Trump's Mind, America's Soul. So let's talk about this phenomenon, which I guess you describe as psychological collusion between Trump and his followers. And obviously, it's always been a mistake on the part of Democrats and liberals, particularly like Hillary Clinton, who referred to Trump's followers as deplorable. The last thing you want to do is to have them hunker down in a bunker. And that's pretty much where we are in our divided country, right? So you believe, I take it, that Trump's followers are in a painful state of, like Trump, they're unable to face reality and they're clinging to Trump's delusions. And they don't want the image of their savior or rescuer to be shattered. So yes. Given that that's the situation we're in now, how do you deprogram these people? Or do you think time will tell as Trump goes off into the twilight, even though he could well be around for another 4 years? He could conduct an alternative inauguration, announce his running in 2024, and spend the next 4 years running around the country leading rallies of Lock Up Joe and Hunter Biden. So perhaps
What he's already doing at this point, and that's the danger of it. And unless we understand what is happening in psychological terms, because he has been able to shape and reshape his role, even subvert reality, turn upside down, winning versus losing, all through psychological influence. And so this has been the greatest danger. I wrote the book specifically for this period because I knew that the elections alone will not make him go away. I did not know the results of the election before when I wrote the book, but it was clear that elections alone would not, they were essential, but the people came through in ways that were admirable and truly heavy lifting, where no one else intervened as they were supposed to. The voters came in and gave their opinion, but as you note in from my book, there's a great deal of psychological influence that would be almost truly monumental to try to put on the shoulders of voters alone. So, yes, there's this continual influence he's having, and he'll continue to shape the impression on the part of his followers so that he can advance and that his influence will not diminish, and he'll continue to be an imposing figure in politics and national affairs. And this is why handing power to a severely mentally impaired individual was very dangerous in the first place, because once you give them power, it's very hard to get them to let go. So we're seeing that. We're seeing the hugely detrimental influence that his psychological shaping is having, first on the coronavirus pandemic, which is our rates of death are 5 times the global average, just incomparable to nations of similar economic development and stature. And also we see it from the crisis of democracy that we're experiencing, that he's undermining faith in elections to the point where to a breaking point where half the population may not accept election results. And that is what a democracy hangs on. So these were the fears that I had even before the election. And so I wish to prepare the country for what was coming, to be able to understand Donald Trump, his followers, and national conditions that were facilitating all of this or gave rise to all this in the first place. So you asked, how do we deprogram them? I recommend, first of all, reducing exposure to the offending agent, who is the severely impaired leader. Secondly, you reduce cultic programming. Fox News and a lot of its offshoots are now actually harming public mental health. So that would be the cognitive part that we need to fix. And then address the socioeconomic and cultural conditions that gave rise to the psychological vulnerability in the population in the first place. That's number three. And number four, what we can do to our fellow Trump supporters at the moment, be they in our families, friends, or neighbors, we try to give them emotional support, because that's one of the reasons why they have clung to Donald Trump, because he was promising them the kind of dignity and belonging that these people were not feeling from the rest of the country.
And of course, your new book, Dr. Bandy Lee, Profile of a Nation, Trump's Mind, America's Soul, it basically makes it clear, you compare Trump to an abuser who is the head of the household, and the American public who are the victim, or his victim. And I think to some extent that's been borne out by the Trump's niece, Mary, who's a psychologist, right? The nature of, I guess he inherited his father's role as the abuser and head of the household.
Yes, and Mary Trump and I have spoken. She has a degree in psychology but has not been practicing. So it's very helpful to have her collateral information and family information. But the country really needs to listen to mental health experts. There are thousands of us who have been trying to speak up. We have not been listened to by the media, or actually have been blocked. And so we have predicted the course of this presidency since 4 years ago, and never have been wrong. So I would like to invite the public to visit us at dangerouscase.org, or I also have a website myself, bandylee.com. And thank you for highlighting my latest book, which is public service book, intended to help the nation find its way out of the current predicament and to recover its soul.
So I see to some extent, Dr. Bandy Lee, that Trump, even though, of course, he's been so dominant and so horrendous and such an anomaly, and he's been so detrimental, it's just shocking, and the damage will last well past his tenure. But to some extent, going back to, say, to Sarah Palin, who John McCain chose as his vice president, she seemed to kind of liberate a part of this country that feels overlooked and looked down upon, and that she's sort of an ordinary person, and that people, prior to that, to some extent, voted for people that they thought were more qualified and educated than they were. And I'm not sure that I'm correct here, but I get the feeling that there's a floodgate that's been opened here of people who feel more identity with people like Trump, even though he's obviously a fraud and he's pretending to be a champion of the ordinary folk. But, for example, this crazy stuff that's going on now with Giuliani, the kind of people that Trump has brought out of the woodwork, the kind of people that Trump will give pardons to, this kind of, you know, attack of the low-life zombies that's happening now. I mean, I don't know whether you saw the hearing in Lansing, Michigan with Giuliani, but the woman he chose as a witness was drunk, but she was a very temporary worker in a polling company or voting company that had, she had no qualifications whatsoever. Apparently, she has a criminal record. She sent tapes of herself having sex with her boyfriend to the boyfriend's ex-wife and was convicted and had been just gotten off probation. Yet she was given this credibility. And this is what, I know I'm sort of rambling a bit here, but is there a problem here in the sense that in criticizing Trump's followers, you kind of automatically take an elitist position, and that what he's done is following in the tradition of Sarah Palin. He's sort of liberated a lot of people who feel like they are free now to be themselves, and they have their moment in the sun with Trump, and all of us, the rest of us elitists, are looking down on them.
Well, those kinds of choices are not well-informed, self-interested, healthy choices. In fact, those kinds of choices are furthering the pathology. And so as mental health professionals, we can provide the logic of what happens when the mind starts becoming disordered and wounded. The wounds actually initially may help to recognize the problem and to correct the problem, but after a while, one becomes more and more less and less able to take care of oneself, and the ability to see that something is wrong is taken away. And then, so they would make rather self-defeating choices, and when the condition is very advanced, one would actively seek out conditions that make one worse. So in other words, you end up with a situation where pathology attracts pathology. And it becomes a very dysfunctional cycle, in that people would enthusiastically endorse those who are as disordered as they are, and those who would actually create situations that further impair them, further deprive, further cause psychological injury, and therefore even further this disordered accentuation. And you mentioned Sarah Palin, but I would actually go back further. In my experience, the first time I noted mental pathology in politics is with Newt Gingrich, who brought a system of winning in politics through distraction and disruption, and not allowing a fair discussion to occur. And these are actually signs of pathology. And I'm not diagnosing Mr. Gingrich or anything. I'm just talking about the method and the symptoms and the manifestations that come out in general in politics. And so you've actually had a whole method of gaining political power through the enhancement of pathology. And I've always warned that having a mentally impaired leader is very dangerous in pathology, because it is far more effective at whipping up frenzied, irrational support of the leader, far better than any rational strategy or persuasion. So I often compare this to a car without functioning brakes. The car itself is not fully functioning, but in the beginning it may speed faster and get to its desired destination faster than any fully functioning car. But at the end, at the bottom of the hill, it always crashes. And that would be quite similar to how pathology works. In the beginning, it may seem very efficient and able to garner power in ways that, the loyalty and the dedication that Donald Trump is able to procure from his followers is far greater than any rational, fully mature adult with a conscience would stoke from the public. But it's not a healthy support because, as you can see, how they pack themselves in rallies without any precautions in a deadly pandemic. And some studies have shown hundreds, if not thousands, of people have died as a result. This is not healthy, well-informed behavior. This is disordered behavior. And that is why I have argued that pathology needs to be kept out of politics. Doing so will probably eliminate 90% or more of destructiveness in government.
Let's now take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment continuing the conversation with Dr. Bandy Lee.
What goes on in your heart? What goes on?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And we're continuing the conversation with Dr. Bandy Lee, a forensic psychiatrist on the faculty of Yale School of Medicine, who served as director of research for the Center for the Study of Violence, co-founded Yale's Violence and Health Study Group, and leads an academic collaborators group for the World Health Organization. She's the lead organizer of the Duty to Warn conference at Yale University, out of which came the best-selling book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 37 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President. And her latest book just out is Profile of a Nation, Trump's Mind, America's Soul. And in terms of what you warn, that we cannot lose ourselves because of Trump's intimidation and oppression, isn't that exactly what's going on with the Republican lawmakers at the moment? Only about 27 Republican lawmakers in the House and Senate have acknowledged that Biden won the election. The rest of them are intimidated by Trump, and he has a grip over them, and it's shocking.
Yes, exactly. So the usual response without expertise and experience dealing with such personalities, the usual course is actually to enable and to help the disorder. And so we have seen that, how a pathological liar has not even been pointed out as lying in the beginning by the media, and a white supremacist terrorist stoker was not even be able to be called a racist. So why is that? That is part, in fact, of the psychological collusion that happens, not just among those who agree with him and share his pathologies, but also those who oppose him will inevitably find themselves more acquiescent and unable to confront him. And this is actually a natural response. It's a survival response, because such a personality would be capable of harming you in very serious ways. That's why expertise was so important, that mental health experts identify what is happening. We're very familiar with his pathologies, and he's actually not a complicated case at all. He's someone we see very routinely in our practices, and in my case, I specialize in such personalities. And we also have clinically proven methods that work, and the methods are severe limit setting and containment, and also taking away power, taking away weapons from dangerous individuals. And the fact that the ordinary standards of care have not been applied to a president simply because he's president has been damaging both to him and the entire nation, to the point where we're suffering with our lives and our survival. No other country on earth is suffering as dire a pandemic as we are, with multiple number of deaths than should have been. It's considered that anywhere from 70 to 99% of the deaths could have been prevented. And also the economic devastation that is multifold of other nations. And then the mental health effects that will ensue from this, the unnecessarily prolonged shutdowns, the economic devastation without any help, and the worsening of the deadliest pandemic in a century. These are all extremely traumatic events, and it was all foreseen and predicted. We even have a blow-by-blow account as to how we predicted that what happened would happen. 4 years ago, we did not know there would be a pandemic, but we said that faced with a crisis, he would make it far deadlier and more devastating than necessary. And once we found out about the pandemic, we said that the death toll would depend on the president's psychological state, not on the characteristics of the virus. And that's on my website, bandylee.com. So it's not a mystery. We knew that this would be the outcome. Ordinary people cannot call out the seriousness and the deadliness of his mental state, partly because they don't have the expertise. And if they were to call him out, it would sound like an insult. But for medical professionals, it's not an insult, because we're referring to a medical phenomenon and the need for intervention. But we were silenced very early on by the American Psychiatric Association, which acted much like the Attorney General, who came in front of the special counsel's report to claim that it exonerated the president when it actually hadn't. So similarly, the APA came out ahead of conscientious professionals to give the public misinformation that we were being unethical and we were speaking of things we did not know anything about, whereas in fact the APA should have known better, and in fact they later confessed that they had done so for federal funding, to protect their own federal funding. And under this administration that has cut medical and educational funding to the point where our COVID response is worse than many third world countries, actually increased funding for the American Psychiatric Association since their intervention. So we've been silenced by the APA and the media. Their intervention was through public health, public relations, public campaigns, and through the media, not through ethical investigations, as would be the proper procedure, because they don't have an ethical case.
Well, I think you make it really clear why Trump cannot accept the COVID-19 pandemic as being real, because once he accepts the reality of the pandemic, he would have to do something and he'd be held responsible. And that deep down, I'm just quoting from you, deep down, Trump is overrun with the feelings of worthlessness and inadequacy. He's probably of an emotional age of 2 or 3 at best from a psychological standpoint. So is that why this thing has gotten out of control? Because he simply cannot accept being real?
Yes.
Because if he did, he would have to...
He cannot accept reality,
right?
Because if he did, he would have to accept his own inadequacy and incapacity.
So we're the collateral damage then, the American people.
Yes, yes. A very, very tragic situation that the world has looked upon us with pity. And we ourselves have not yet fully grasped the magnitude of the victimization we have been put through by trying to simply defer to a president who was not capable of being president.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Bandy Lee, who is forensic psychiatrist on the faculty of the Yale School of Medicine. Her latest book just out is Profile of a Nation, Trump's Mind, America's Soul, the book wrapping up here in support of Background Briefing, and KPFK at 818-985-5735. So do you think that Trump really believes he won the election?
Yes, that's a question that often comes up. I think we see from the results that he's not able to accept it, a combination of being unable to accept and being criminally driven to cause a great deal of destruction before ever doing anything that's inconvenient for him, make it clear that functionally it's the same as a delusion, which is a fixed false belief that is impermeable to evidence, facts and evidence. I don't think he starts out that way. I think he starts out lying and wishing to believe that this were the case. But eventually, emotionally, he's not able to accept reality, so it does become a functional delusion. The problem with the delusion is that it is actually more convincing than strategic lies, because the person himself is convinced of it, and so he's more persuasive to his followers, and also because of the emotional drive behind the falsehood. The emotional drive is what gets transmitted, and it works almost like a contagious disease. I often point out the phenomenon of shared psychosis, or it's an older phrase would be folie à deux, trois, quatre, or folie à millions. It can reach a madness of millions. And that usually happens when it is a pathological symptom, unlike simple misinformation or a strategic lie. An actual symptom, such as a delusion, spreads among the population much more quickly.
So just in the last minute, Dr. Bandy Lee, is there something you could say to our audience as to why they need your new book, Profile of a Nation, Trump's Mind and America's Soul? Because we're going to be in this state of peril for some time, both Trump supporters and the rest of us, along with this pandemic. So we are heading into a very dark period. So what would your final advice be as to why people need to get your book?
Yes, I wrote the book specifically for this period, anticipating that things would become more perilous after the election rather than before. And because avoiding facing the situation does not make the problem go away. We've tried that for 4 years. And it also does not help people's anxiety and feelings of helplessness. Understanding a problem alone and naming a problem helps already psychologically, but also practically. Suddenly, solutions start to appear when we understand the situation better. And I encourage people to understand the situation as a whole. I talk about an ecological approach in the book, that is understanding Donald Trump in the context of his followers and the nation as a whole. So the book is intended to provide some ways of helping us through this period. It also gives some psychological techniques for taking care of ourselves and our emotional health, but also points to the origin of all the problems that we have been seeing, not just in Donald Trump or his followers, but in the nation as a whole. What kind of conditions gave rise to the psychological injuries and vulnerabilities that we see that has made a presidency like this even possible, and for it to continue this long? And once we understand this, I think people will sense that the problem is much more manageable and that the solutions are not a mystery, and that in order to solve the problem and not to continue to be mired into it, we do need to understand what is happening. And that's what I'm trying my best to provide.
Well, Dr. Bandy Lee, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Bandy Lee, who's a forensic psychiatrist on the faculty of Yale School of Medicine, who served as director of research for the Center of the Study of Violence, co-founded Yale's Violence and Health Study Group, and leads an academic collaborators group for the World Health Organization. She's the lead organizer. She is the lead organizer of the Duty to Warn conference at Yale University, out of which came the best-selling book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 37 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President. And her latest book just out is Profile of a Nation, Trump's Mind, America's Soul. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Bye for now.
Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by half past 9. Who left?
Your news, your views, your values. This is WMN.